In the coming week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits Mexico. Sweden holds its general elections amid Europe's energy crisis, and the leaders of Russia, India, and China meet at a summit in Uzbekistan. It's September 8th, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, I'd like to start off with a visit occurring in our hemisphere. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is going to visit Mexico. Now, the visit is apparently going to be focusing on economic matters. There's a whole host of things they could talk about, but there are also quite a bit on the economic front. So could you give a sense of what we should be looking for in this visit?
Certainly, Bob. The meeting is a continuation of the high-level economic dialogue between the United States and Mexico, which resumed last year after a four-year hiatus. Now, it may seem odd to many listeners to hear that the U.S. Secretary of State is going to be leading a U.S. delegation to any discussion about economics, given that the State Department doesn't have much of a role in U.S. economic affairs, whether domestic or foreign. Commerce has a much bigger domestic portfolio than the State Department does, obviously. And the U.S. Trade Representative has the point on trade negotiations. To the best of my knowledge, Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo is not set to join Secretary Blinken, nor is Catherine Tsai, who is the USTR. And again, this reflects the fact that under the American system, the Secretary of State is the point person in international negotiations. Now, when you look at the discussions that Secretary Blinken is set to have, there's clearly a positive part of the agenda. And that positive part is about how to improve cross-border supply chains. Both COVID and rising tensions with China increased interest, certainly on the U.S. side, in shortening supply chains and moving toward what we would call friendshoring. That is, making sure that critical production comes from countries you believe that you can rely on. Now, some of the specific industries likely to come up in discussions between Secretary Blinken and his Mexican counterpart next week will be semiconductor production and medical equipment. And, you know, there are clear benefits to both countries if they can develop and deepen supply chains in these areas. But there are two issues that are really forming what we might call the divisive part of the agenda, and a third issue which is looming in the background. Let me get to the two divisive issues that are likely to be discussed. One is energy policy. Now, back in July, the United States activated the dispute settlement process created by the USMCA Free Trade Agreement. And when the United States activated the dispute settlement process, it alleged that the Mexican government has discriminated against U.S. and Canadian energy firms in favor of the Mexican government-owned power company and the National Mexican Oil Company. People may have heard of it. It's Pemex. Now, the backdrop to all of this is that the energy sector in Mexico historically was protected from outside investment. The previous Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, succeeded in getting a constitutional amendment passed to open up Mexico's energy industry. The idea was that the decision to protect the industry had made it costly and inefficient, and that if Mexico opened up its energy sector to foreign investment, you would get innovation, that would create efficiencies, it would lower costs and benefit Mexicans. Now, administration's changed, got a new president in Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known by AMLO, and he has a decidedly different, let's call it old-fashioned, old-school take on the energy sector, that it should be protected from foreign investment because that would give other countries leverage over Mexico. And he, in many ways, has rolled back the changes that the Peña Nieto administration had put in place. Now, the process that the United States triggered back in July by filing its petition could take a year or more. And if the U.S. petition succeeds, it will lead to punitive tariffs on Mexico. Now, of course, whenever you go into a legal matter like this, you don't know whether you're going to win or you're going to lose. And that creates an incentive for both the United States and Mexico to perhaps find a way to negotiate and settle their differences. And it's pretty clear that signals coming out of Mexico City recently is that the Mexican government wants to have a conversation, a dialogue on this. I should also note that the Mexican government would say we have our own complaints about the United States, and particularly about the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act. You may recall that when that bill was passed, it was hailed for making a very big down payment by the United States in fighting climate change. Part of that was by providing a range of incentives for the production of electric vehicles. Now, Mexican government officials complained that those incentives put Mexican auto plants at a disadvantage. Now, keep in mind, American automobile manufacturers operate plants in Mexico. Parts go back and forth. We've talked about that supply chain before. And the concern of the Mexican government is that those plants are going to be disadvantaged or hurt by the Inflation Reduction Act and the incentives it contains therein. Now, the Mexicans, to the best of my knowledge, have not yet filed a petition to the dispute settlement process. That obviously is something that could possibly happen. And my sense is the Mexican government's hoping that the meeting with Secretary Blinken will lead to some progress that would sort of alleviate the need to invoke the dispute settlement provisions. The other divisive issue is Ukraine. As you know, Bob, the Biden administration has sought to enlist countries in its effort to isolate Russia. Now, President AMLO has shown no interest in following President Biden's lead. AMLO has condemned the Russian invasion of Ukraine as illegitimate, but he's also suggested that NATO's policy is immoral, and he has steadfastly refused to impose sanctions on Russia. I don't expect that Secretary Blinken will have any success in changing the official position of the Mexican government on Ukraine, Bob. And one last thing, and this is really sort of part of the context for all of this, there's great concern in the U.S. government about democratic backsliding in Mexico. Our colleague Shannon O'Neill has written several pieces on this, sort of detailing how AMLO's government has really walked back a lot of the political opening and political reforms enacted under prior Mexican governments. Secretary Blinken has in the past talked about the very stunning sharp rise in attacks and murders of journalists in Mexico. I don't know that that's necessarily going to be on the formal agenda, but if it's not something that comes up in the conversation, it's clearly hovering over the dialogue.
Yeah, so as always, Jim, as you laid it out, like a huge number of potential issues to go over on a what's still not that lengthy a trip. But I guess for starters, I'd be interested in knowing the Spanish translation of friendshoring when you get a chance, Jim. That would be very
well. You should get Shannon to come on the podcast to co-host, and I'm sure she would be happy to fill you in. I'm not going to take a stab at that.
We'll follow that one up. But, you know, as you noted, and it's sometimes overlooked, there is an enormous amount of trade between the U.S. and Mexico. Just look at the truck traffic between the two countries on any given day, for example. You know, far beyond the other border issues, that those traffic borders need to be open to keep all sorts of supply chains moving in the area. So these are actually very consequential talks. I am wondering whether, you know, they will, beyond what you're talking about with the safety of journalists, Jim, the overall security situation also seems to be pretty parlous in Mexico with the upsurge in certainly the drug cartel activities and certain areas where there have been recent reports, areas of Mexican society that had been kind of closed off from violence are now seeing themselves hit by it in various ways. That's raising concern on north of the border as well, and whether or not there might be further discussion that involves maybe aspects of both human rights, but also security cooperation, because these things tend to be, you know, shared. There's an ongoing Mexican interest in restricting gun flows from the U.S. south and U.S. restricting drug flows as well as migrant flows north. So it seems like any number of huge issues could overtake this meeting.
You're right, Bob. And if you look at the trends in Mexico across the board in terms of the economy, in terms of violence, in terms of drug trafficking, in terms of democratic backsliding, all of the arrows are pointing in the wrong direction. Now, again, Mexicans would argue, and I think with some justification, that the United States has, through its policies, helped contribute to Mexico's problem, particularly with the voracious demand for drugs here in the United States and America's lax gun laws, which allow a flow of guns to go back into Mexico. And I think the Mexicans, again, have legitimate complaint. I would say more broadly looking at this, the future of Mexico is very important to the United States. Shannon wrote a book two nations indivisible, which painted what had been at that time a series of positive trends that augured well for both countries. But right now we have difficult relations. AMLO and Biden don't really hit it off. You may recall that back in the spring, AMLO refused to come to the Summit of the Americas that the Biden administration hosted, I think in Los Angeles, arguing that Nicaragua and Cuba should have been allowed to attend. We also have just the historical legacy. There is a lot of resentment in Mexico toward what they see as historical American domination, imperialism in their country, having retarded their own development. And so I think these things make it difficult. I do think in looking at the Biden administration, one can fairly ask at the end of the day, what is its policy, not just toward Mexico, but toward Latin America more broadly? You may recall when candidate Biden was running, he talked, as a number of past presidential candidates had talked, about really sort of reorienting American policy south of the border. We haven't really seen that policy take root. And indeed, I think you can find a fair number of people who follow U.S. Latin American policy to say that the Biden administration has clearly allowed Latin America to fall down the list of priorities. Again, for people we know who work in the government, they would say it's a complicated world out there. There are a lot of big issues, China, Ukraine, Russia, climate change, and the rest. I do think for American security and American prosperity, getting relations with Mexico right are important, but it's a challenge because we don't have the ability to correct the things in Mexico that deeply trouble us. And to some extent, as we've seen in many instances, both with Mexico and other countries, our attempts to go in and be helpful can be counterproductive.
Yeah. And as you alluded to, I think the figure of AMLO poses another layer of challenges, certainly different challenges than, say, a few of his predecessors might have in terms of his approach to the world. And it is interesting to note he did strike up somewhat of a pragmatic working relationship with President Trump over issues like, you know, migrant flows with the Remain in Mexico policy and so forth.
Very, very true, Bob. And again, I think we'll come back to the issue of U.S.-Mexico relations in future podcasts. But for now, let's shift gears and move to Europe. On Sunday, Swedes will cast their ballots in a general election. In recent years, far-right groups around the world have gained traction in mainstream politics. Sweden is no exception. The dominant left-wing Social Democrats face a strong challenge from the far-right ethno-nationalist Sweden Democrats. What can you tell us about this election, Bob, and what it means for Sweden?
Well, I think it's been, by all indications, it has been portrayed as another crucial test in a major European election about the role of right and far right parties in national politics. And there seems to be a very real chance that this party known as Sweden Democrats, which has a history going back to the Nazi era in terms of Nazi sympathies and so forth, raises a lot of great concerns. Now, we should note also the context here. We're entering into a season of several elections, actually, a really big one coming up at the end of the month in Italy. I think Austria's got presidential election next month. Latvia's got parliamentary elections. And they are happening in a context of a growing energy crisis for Europe that has only been further exacerbated by recent comments by Russian President Putin about holding off flows of natural gas on the Nord Stream pipeline, through which Europe has up to now gotten a large amount of its gas. It is causing a great deal of scurrying in EU capitals and a whole different set of approaches. And Sweden is no exception. We're seeing policy announcements coming out from the government about assisting people's ability to pay energy bills. There have been ideas floated about making nuclear power, you know, something more viable. And belt tightening is in the mix as well. And amidst this all, there's ongoing, as typical in European elections this year and previous years, Russian campaigns to sort of foster misinformation and further sort of stir up any hornet's nests or looming ones about issues that rile up people. Now, in Sweden, you also have an issue of rising crime. The Sweden is seen as the paragon of social democracy and peacefulness and so forth is a bit of a faded image for some in terms of it's been dealing with sort of unprecedented crime recently, and that's been a campaign issue that parties on the right, not just the far right, but also the right, that are running on. So you have a social democrat party that is now going into the election in the lead. The prime minister is Magdalena Andersson, She is, by many accounts, very popular. In fact, probably more popular than her party, according to some of the polling that has come out. And so there's a really sort of a razor-thin difference in polling between cluster of parties that represent left of center to left issues, positions, and right. And the Democrat, the Sweden Democrats that are getting all the attention have a, what sounds like a familiar set of platform issues, including a strong set of issues countering Sweden's longstanding policies on asylum and migration. They want to severely crimp that back. They make linkages between immigrants and crime and all sorts of other issues that deal with Swedish nationhood and so forth. They have a slogan that is similar to sort of make America great again. It's, I believe it translates to something like make Sweden great again. And they are led by Jimmy Åkesson, who's very sort of media savvy and has sought to distance himself from previous far right positions and legacy of the party. He has been in some ways accepted into the fold of the more moderate right of center parties in Sweden. So there's a question of whether after these elections and with all the concerns that are swirling about crime, about energy and so forth, whether or not Sweden is dealing with a delicate balancing act between left and right. I'll add one more thing, which is Sweden is on the path to NATO membership, which earlier this year, up to and through the spring, was gaining actually a great deal of popularity, although it is not something that the Sweden Democrats are strongly promoting.
So what is the election going to mean for NATO membership? Because Sweden has formally applied, Bob. Last I checked, 24 NATO members have already ratified its ascension. You need to get all NATO members to do so. But are there second thoughts or buyer's remorse in Sweden over NATO membership? Is this something the Sweden Democrats have taken a position on along with their ethno-nationalist policies?
I have not seen any sort of campaigning or strong policy as it relates to NATO membership from the Sweden Democrats, from the far right. However, they have been more neutral than certainly the rest of the Swedish public on the issue of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and not calling out Russia for criticism and so forth. It could be one of these situations where you have ascending to power, they feel like they have a little bit more leverage to step forward and start to change the calculus. But I think gauging from the popularity of NATO membership, this is something that is, still has a force of its own that they do not see as necessary to tamper with. But I think it's worth watching very closely. That's one of the reasons why Sweden's elections will be studied across Europe and the world, frankly, much more closely than probably any in recent memory. So, and again, it's a whole host of issues. And there is Russia's attempts to try to sort of mess around with the narrative, with the conversation. Sweden is used to such campaigns and I think is running its own counter-hacking and counter-misinformation campaigns. But still in all, it's the timing is crucial. And you have a Swedish vote taking place at, you know, amid a Ukraine campaign that has now entered a, what looks like a Ukrainian counteroffensive and a Russian a rhetorical counteroffensive as it relates to energy. And that is getting a lot of attention in Europe.
Yeah, certainly so, Bob. And I know later this month, the Italians go to the polls and there have been many efforts apparently by the Russians to try to influence the outcome of that election where parties on the right have been surging in power. And I think there's some predictions that they may actually form a majority coalition. So we'll see how all of that plays out. It's definitely a very interesting month.
Yeah. And we saw in France in their parliamentary elections, the move to the right as well. And so posing further challenges for Emmanuel Macron. The EU has been holding a flurry of meetings recently. The Czechs, who hold the current rotating presidency, are trying to get some sense of consensus on the energy position, on the position of how much the bloc will pay for Russian gas, which Russians are extremely unhappy with. And it's causing a great deal of sort of petro-politics right now. But it is going to reverberate electorally. And the question is how much, what sort of democratic calculus are we seeing playing out in Sweden right now? Again, where you have a popular woman at the helm of a party that might be losing its sway, a far-right group that has a strong anti-immigrant overtones, certainly outside the major urban areas. It's going to be very interesting to watch. And we'll be talking more, Jim. I think we'll continue on our series of electoral geopolitical moments.
I perhaps should have paid more attention when I took comparative politics way back in the day.
Well, everybody's getting a full dose of it right now. But Jim, I want to move us a little bit further east into Eurasia / Central Asia for a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, this is an organization that started up about a dozen or so, dozen to 20 years ago. It's continued to percolate along. It's a vehicle that China very much has interest in supporting, and Russia increasingly has, but it also includes India. And it looks at this point like you will have the presidents of Russia, China, and India attending the summit in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. It's hoping to address, according to the sort of agenda sketched out, peace and stability in the region, as well as issues like poverty, food security, which certainly resonates. Jim, could you give us a sense of what this summit's going to yield on a practical basis?
I suspect, Bob, this is going to be a summit that is marked more by who shows up than what gets done. As you note, the three headliners would be President Xi, Prime Minister Modi, President Putin. What's remarkable about President Xi's appearance is that it will be the first time since before COVID that President Xi leaves China, or territory China claims, to travel abroad. You may recall earlier this year he made news by going to Hong Kong very briefly. So having President Xi leave China to go to Uzbekistan is seen as a significant event, and we will see what the optics are. Now, I perhaps should step back and talk a little bit about what the SCO is. As you mentioned, it's about 20 years old. It was founded back in 2001. The original founding members were China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. And the organization was set up in Beijing. Members have been added since then. India and Pakistan joined in 2017. Iran is now joining. I think one of the things that's going to come up at the summit is whether Belarus should be admitted as a member of the organization. Now, it was set up, the SCO, in essence, to sort of build ties within the region, within Central Asia. It was a big initiative by the Chinese. And it reminds us that, you know, after World War II, there was a series of institution building efforts led by the United States to create things like the United Nations and a whole variety of regional organizations, the Organization of American States, NATO, and the rest. And this was clearly an effort by the Chinese to start to build an institutional infrastructure that represented their interests and that gave them a voice and could shape their neighborhood. And I think it's important, you know, we keep in mind that international institutions can be born, they can change, and they can adapt. When you look at the SCO right now, what you're struck is, in some ways, it's a set of odd bedfellows. While they are neighbors and they have relations with one another, those relations aren't always good. And probably at the top there would be the relationship between India and China. Even as Prime Minister Modi goes to Samarkand and meets with President Xi, the backdrop is that Chinese and Indian forces are squared off against one another in the Himalayas over disputed areas. There have been clashes over the past couple of years. Soldiers have died on both sides. And this is an issue that's very important to the Indians. The Indians have agreed to participate with the American military in exercises in the Himalayas to talk about mountain warfare training. I suspect that is not an accident and is definitely intended as a signal to China. And recently, India's external minister, that's their term for what we would call Secretary of State or foreign minister, said that as far as India was concerned, that the state of the border will determine the state of the relationship with China. You might think relations are really good between Beijing and Moscow, and for the most part, they are, but there still are some tensions there. Again, they share a very long border. There is some concern in Russia about becoming essentially a vassal to Beijing. I think clearly Beijing has a sense that it is the senior partner in any sort of relationship like this. Russia was behind the effort in 2017 to expand membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and news reports have suggested that Beijing was very displeased with it because it's worried that as the organization grows in size, it becomes harder to direct or steer. And clearly the Chinese are interested in using these organizations to press their agenda.
Yeah, I think it'll be just the personal dynamics, maybe some of the most compelling things about this summit, including Modi and Putin. You know, India's obviously charted a pretty independent path as it relates to the Ukraine war. buying quite a bit of Russian energy, which is helping Russia as its markets dry up in the West. And also armaments, apparently that has not really changed since the invasion started. I'm also interested in the dynamic, Jim, involving some of the other former Soviet leaders there who have not necessarily been in lockstep with Putin as he's trying to kind of consolidate a zone of Russian influence, especially Kazakhstan. Its President Tokayev has made a number of remarks that are quite, let's say, independent-minded and if not, rebukes to Russia and what it's done in Ukraine.
You're exactly right, Bob. Again, this is an organization whose members may live in the same general geographical area. They don't share the same interest, and indeed a number of them are very concerned about the others. And I failed to point out, obviously, that Pakistan is going to be there. Long-standing divisions between India and Pakistan. And one of the great concerns right now, and we've talked about it before, is we're seeing a lot of political tumult in Pakistan. It has been basically fueled by the recent floods and the disaster, the failure of the Pakistani government to be able to meet the needs of its people. Pakistan has become much closer to China and less tied to the United States over the last decade or so. That obviously is something that concerns individuals in New Delhi, given just the state of Indo-Pakistani relations. On the flip side, India has long had good ties with Russia. That takes us back to the Indian-Soviet relationship. Soviet Union, for much of the Cold War, was a major supplier of arms to India, and many Indians have very fond feelings toward, well, Soviet Union or toward Russia, which is one of the reasons why Prime Minister Modi has not, contrary to the hopes of many Americans who want to see a development of a U.S.-India relationship in strategic partnership, really condemned forcefully what the Russians have done. And there have been many complaints here in the United States about India's failure to condemn the Russian invasion and the willingness of India to buy cut-rate discounted oil from Russia. So again, a lot of conflicting, cross-cutting currents both at this summit meeting, but also in the relationship that these countries have with countries outside the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
And I think the mere, existence of the SCO for more than 20 years says something about the need for these countries that they feel the need to continue this kind of dialogue, even when they're at cross purposes in some cases.
Yeah, I think the great fear is if you don't show up, what will happen and how will it affect your interests? But with that, Bob, let's talk about our audience figure of the week. As always, listeners can vote on or tweet us their figures of the week at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected the figure of 1.5 million kids in famine risk. Tell me about it.
Jim, this is in some ways a coda to last week's, or a little bit of a climate counterpoint to, I believe it was last week's, on Pakistan and the severe flooding. Well, we also have the extreme climate conditions that we are witnessing seemingly everywhere have also created severe drought. And Somalia is dealing with a drought the likes of which it hasn't seen, although it has seen its share of them. This one is seemingly one it hasn't seen in more than a generation now, close to 40 years by some accounts. That, on top of conflict and other issues, has created a great deal of concern about a looming famine. And this past, I believe it was this past week, the top UN official, Martin Griffiths, who's the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and the Emergency Relief Coordinator at the UN, said almost 1.5 million children across Somalia are going to face the risk of acute malnutrition by next month. Now, there are many other figures we could also pluck as well, including almost 250,000 people who are at an imminent risk of dying. And we should say that figure resonates because the last time Somalia dealt with a severe drought 7 or 8 years ago, about that many people died. There was a major effort to respond and get aid quickly into Somalia, and that helped save a lot of lives. Now, the concern is when the UN mentions famine, it's already sort of a tipping point in which when famine is announced, there are some people who cannot be helped, whereas you are still helping others who are more on the cusp. So We're looking at potentially, you know, the situation like some people might recall from the 1980s period of time that generated a great deal of international response and major concerts and so forth for the Ethiopian famine relief. This is one that it's on a similar scale. We should also notice not just Somalia, that there are ramifications and drought and famine concerns, you know, that almost go throughout the Horn of Africa. But Somalia is the most acute. We talked recently, I believe, on the podcast, Jim, about the Al-Shabaab phenomenon and that they're not going away. That has certainly contributed to the problems in that you can't get any sort of normal, certainly governance into regions that are hard hit. And you have these regions, particularly two areas, Baydoa and Burkahaba districts in south central Somalia, that are looking at famine between October and December, according to the latest report of what's called the Somalia Food Security and Nutrition Report. On top of everything else, we've mentioned it repeatedly again, there is donor fatigue or there is donor saturation in some ways because of all the concerns, whether it's the Pakistan flooding and flooding in other parts of the world or drought in other places, including Africa, including the Sahel region. And so, again, a real hard problem to approach in any sort of comprehensive way. But the language of Martin Griffiths, who's a seasoned veteran of such things, is one that I think got a lot of attention because it was so stark.
Certainly is, Bob. And I think that the increasing prevalence of extreme weather events that we have been witnessing and in all likelihood are going to continue to experience is going to increase the risk of famine around the world, not just in the Horn of Africa. And as you point out, we are not equipped either as individual countries or collectively as an international community, if I can use that phrase, to deal with those sorts of issues. And I would hope that world leaders begin to spend more time thinking about how we can jointly work to aid people who find themselves in these situations because they're going to grow in number.
It's significant you mentioned world leaders, Jim, because one place that typically the world turns to is the chamber like the UN Security Council, where there is a sort of historic level of rancor right now, largely over, but not exclusively over, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia being a permanent member of the Security Council, China's a member, US, UK, and France are permanent members. And just this week, at the same time, Vladimir Putin was threatening to, you know, a long-term cutoff of energy flows to Europe, he was also saying that there might have to be a need to renegotiate the deal that loosened up flows of grain from Ukrainian ports, saying Western countries were cynically keeping the supplies for Western European markets and not for the poor countries that they deserved, which a number of people have challenged as untrue. There have not been a great deal of...
You call it disinformation.
It's called disinformation. And while some of those shipments have not yet arrived, they are on their way to these countries who badly need them. And Putin's comments, his rhetoric, are, as ever, highly unwelcome and just could further serve to make the situation even worse.
Agreed.
Well, that's our look at a world in upheaval next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Kazakhstan hosts the Congress of Leaders of World and Traditional Religions, and the U.S. Senate's Foreign Relations Committee debates Taiwan's right to self-determination.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. We love the feedback. The articles and books mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Esther Fang with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia and Esther Fang engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Esther. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying, so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye and be careful out there.